This is recorded February 7th, 2018. We are live here today at the California Association of Museums Annual Conference. This year, it is happening in Palm Springs, California. I'm here because I'm speaking on a panel about virtual museums. As a CEO several years ago, my staff and I created a virtual version of our museum online before it was ever cool to do so. So today I'm talking about that experience and helping others create virtual visits to their museums. So, I thought I would use this opportunity to talk to museum professionals and ask them about all the BS in the museum industry. I set up a booth in the hallway, and these are the fantastic jewels that I collected. Welcome to 501c3 BS, deprogramming for organizational growth. I'm your host, Zoot Velasco.
We just need one big fundraiser.
Our clients are our donors.
Bigger is better.
Who cares what the mission statement is?
I work in nonprofits.
Bullshit! Let's start at the top.
My name is Celeste Wald, and I'm the executive director of the California Association of Museums, the organization that is putting the conference on.
The head honcho herself. All right, you must have in your career heard many myths about our sector that are just completely wrong.
Misconceptions.
Yeah.
The one of my favorites is that nonprofits can't lobby or advocate.
Okay, we're working on a whole episode on that for this season of 501c3 BS, so I'm going to move her answer into that podcast, and you'll hear what she says about advocacy when we talk about advocacy and all the mythology around it. Let's move on. Next, I spoke with some people at a really wonderful small automobile museum in Los Angeles, and they had a really interesting take on some of the mythology around small museums and small organizations. Check this out.
I'm Marisol Rios. I'm from the Automobile Driving Museum in El Segundo.
Awesome. Yeah. And you are?
My name is Tara Hitzig, and I'm the executive director of the Automobile Driving Museum. We are a smaller museum that has a collection of about 130, 140 cars that we like to call ourselves the petting zoo of car museums because we are the tactile experience. You get to come in, sit in our cars, experience the cars, and we take people for rides in them. So anything from our 1909 Ford Model T all the way up to 1985, 2000
Mustang
Saline, yeah, will take you for a ride in the car on Sundays. So we have all the different cars.
What is your 501c3 BS?
That a small museum is boring, that our collections are not exciting or have enough, or they're old, that there might not be enough educational experiences, yeah, which there is. A lot of people think that we, maybe because we have a smaller budget, that we can't do as much, but we are constantly doing events for the community and families.
In actuality, small museums do more sometimes than large museums because there's no bureaucracy, they're nimble, they're quick, and they wear a lot of hats.
That is true that, we can kind of do more in the sense, I just came from a session with all small museums, and the one thing that we all said that was nice about being in a small museum is that we could say, I'm going to try this. We're going to start it tomorrow. And we didn't have to get a lot of approvals and go through a political or a bureaucracy or a bunch of directors and heads to answer. And if it fails, you can go, okay, we won't do that again. Let's start something new. So that's the nice part about being in a smaller institution, because you have that flexibility.
They had some interesting insights into boards for small organizations as well.
Sometimes boards are not as active because the board might be family members or friends or the only person in town that really wants to be on the board for the museum. So that can be challenging as well. Keeping the board engaged is about the staff, whether you have two staff members, our museum has six, and getting the staff very involved and working all together as a really tight team and showing the board, see what we can do. I think that's important.
So what kind of programs do you use to keep people engaged at your small organization?
Think outside the box, definitely. Try until you get something right. You know, like we did evenings at the museum and that blew up on us, and it was really great. Not blew up badly, blew up great. We have events for both adults and children. So we would have local breweries come and have their beer tasting there, and we'd have a live yacht band, and we also have like skate night with roller derby girls, and it just all worked very well. And then the car shows as well. Sometimes they're a major hit and sometimes they're just a flop, like our Lowrider show, which we were really surprised because we're in Los Angeles. Yep. And then the ones that really worked are like the Mustang shows or like the Camaro. So everybody loves muscle cars. We learned that. So yeah, it's just keep trying until you get something right. You get a right algorithm.
I think a big part of what we did too is really create that tight-knit team, work together with the same mission, and we go out to the community now. When we came on board, they weren't doing many things with the community. I'm on the city chamber board of directors. Marisol is an ambassador for the city. We do Rotary, Kiwanis. We work with the local schools, and we actually sponsor the school events. We go to so many little community events and we drive our cars all over Southern California to other car shows, so we don't expect them just to come to us. I think last year we did 25 to 30 off-site other car shows.
While small organizations are working hard just to stay afloat and be active in the community, large organizations are working hard to see that they're getting the most out of earned revenue and all the mythology around that. For more, I talked to Michael Shanklin, the CEO of Kids Space Museum, a large organization in Pasadena, California.
Hi, good morning. I'm Michael Shanklin, the CEO of Kids Space Children's Museum. The mythology, boy, that's a great question. You know, I think that I work at a unique place. I work at Kids Space Children's Museum. We obviously serve a very specific demographic. So I think this concept of nonprofits, I think that our industry, so many in our industry of the museum business think that, you know, nonprofits is a business plan instead of a tax status. And I recognize that my institution's a little unique in that we're about 85 to 90% earned revenue, which when I say that, a lot of people raise their eyebrows. So I constantly challenge myself and my peers to say, you know, we should be making a profit and we should be storing our profit for the betterment of our, you know, of our public. And so I'm not really shy about raising prices because I value our product. And I think a lot of our peers are like, well, we couldn't raise prices because we don't want to alienate people. And yes, that's absolutely true. But at the same time, you know, I think when you price your product appropriately, people see value from that, and it helps you achieve your mission. So we served about 80,000 guests last year that were either completely free or dramatically reduced. And, you know, and sometimes we do that through grants. Sometimes we do that through our profits for the institution. But I guess that's the mythology, I would say, that, you know, you've got to value your product and you've got to... Don't be afraid, you know, be bold in terms of making some big earned revenue decisions.
So let's talk about that. So how many guests total did you have last year?
We broke an attendance record. We have 371,433 to be exact.
And 80,000 of them were lower reduced admission.
Exactly.
So you're both hitting a price point that the market will bear, but at the same time giving an out for people who can't afford that price.
Absolutely. And I think that's the balance that an institution has to strike, is that if we were all about the profit and we said, look, we're going to price ourselves at $20 a head, and we did nothing to serve the low to moderate income families, I think that would be wrong. So I think that's where you have to balance that earned revenue stream that is bringing in a good amount of money with the low to moderate income programming and admission, because I think one without the other is not wise.
Right. And then you're not really a community organization if you're not serving the community.
Right, right. I think your mission gets lost in the desire for the earned revenue.
But what you're saying is very interesting, and it does bust one of the myths of the sector, is that we can't value our services at a reasonable price point because we're nonprofit.
Exactly. Yeah, I firmly believe that. And I think as an industry, we tend to devalue our own product. And our product is amazing. We inspire people every single day. And so, you know, we should, and people don't value sometimes what they don't pay for. So even with our Museums for All initiative, which is a joint partnership with the Association of Children's Museums and IMLS, you can charge, the crux of the program is that if a family comes with an EBT card, which is a kind of a modern form of food assistance, then they present that at the museum gate, and the outline of the program says that you can charge $0 for that or up to $3. We started not charging for that, but I think that you've got to have a little bit of skin in the game. I mean, even when, you know, I was eating ramen noodles and ketchup, you know, for college dinner, you know, I think I found money for the things that were important to me. And I grew up in a very poor home, so I don't come from an elitist perspective. But I think it's important to charge something.
So what do you charge for people who are on EBT?
We charge $3.
And as opposed to the regular mission is?
Which is 14. So
significant decrease, but enough for them to know.
Right.
To feel comfortable that they paid for something.
Right. Absolutely. So, you know, I think that that whole museum...
If there were a class from a Title I school, what would you do with a class from a Title I school versus a class from a wealthy private school?
Right. So the two directions we could go with that, if we've been successful in our fundraising, on occasion we do have scholarships for, you know, for the transportation as well as the admission price. The other option is we charge $9 for group admission, which also includes a program for that class.
That's for just any school.
That's correct.
And then do you do a special deal for kids from very low-income schools?
We do. And sometimes those programs involve us going out to the school. Sometimes those involve them coming to us with some sort of a scholarship opportunity. Because there's no easy fundraising. But I would say that supporting Title I schools is easier than certainly raising money for operations. So that's something we often go for.
So for a Title I school, it would be the $3 again?
That's correct.
That's great. And so that's all done through grants, generally?
Correct. Some grants, some individual donors are really passionate about that. Of course, you know, we always look for the funds from the foundations that are completely unrestricted. I think one of the things that we did a few years ago, which was really groundbreaking for us, is that we looked at all of the access programs that we did, and we were fundraising individually for them, and that is one strategy that you can take. But when we stopped and looked at all the programs we did, we added up all the numbers of the guests we were serving, and we looked at the price tag for all of those. We were shocked at how many kids we were serving and how much that was being subsidized. So we started to bulk all those together in a kids space for all access program. And then instead of shopping for a grant for $50,000, I should say, instead of shopping for a program that was $50,000, we started sending out grants that were for the entire program, which was somewhere in the neighborhood of $600,000 to $800,000, and our grant asks could be much higher. So when we bulked all that together, it really made that ask much more compelling.
Michael is my kind of organizational leader. Somebody tells him that he can't charge more for his programs, he looks at the science of it and figures out that he can. Somebody tells him he can't apply for grants because his programs are too small, he bundles them together and figures out a way to apply for those grants. Sometimes you just have to get past the myth. Next, I interviewed Michael from GeoPogo. GeoPogo is a company that makes virtual museums. They worked with me on my panel. He was talking specifically about the mythology around marketing.
My name is Michael Hoppe. I work with GeoPogo, and I'm the business development director. So GeoPogo is our answer to virtual and augmented reality. We started off as architects, and we've worked and branched into multiple fields, and here today we're extending our services to museums.
How many times have you heard people say, oh, we need to have our own app? Everybody wants their museum app. Michael thinks this is a lot of BS. He thinks that app technology is an endangered species, and that we'd be much better served by having everything load and work from our websites.
Well, there's a couple of pain points. If you start off, how do you get an app? And you're typically looking at a price tag budget, let's say, to get a company to make you an app that's downloadable on the iTunes store or on the Android store, you should expect about, say, $15,000 to $20,000 on a mid-range. And that just depends on what the app can do. But more importantly, it's distinguishing yourself from the other apps that's out there on the market, the probably hundreds of thousands, if not in the millions now, of apps that are out there. And then also with that, the pain points to getting people to download your app. It's a nuisance, and we've seen it over and over again where you say, somebody says, download our app, check out the iTunes store, and you got to search for it, and then you find it, and then a couple of things come to question. How actually interested are you in downloading this app? What happens when your phone is full of data? Now you got to start deleting stuff to get this app. Well, things start, well, what can I delete? And then eventually, once you've spent a couple minutes in the situation, you're like, I don't really care. And you pass it on and you go off. And this has been something that people in the Bay Area have been noticing. When we talked to a company, well, Samsung, where their new involvement is augmented reality. And they don't feel that apps are the solution for the new augmented reality tech. Web. Just base everything on the web. That way there, if you're sending an email to somebody, just link it. You just say, hey, check this out. Here's a link. And it goes right to their phone. There's no app. There's no downloads. There's no... You're not relying on your customers to have to invest to see your experience. They don't want to invest to see your experience. They just want to see it. And that's why the web is so important, is because it's instantaneous.
My next participant at my booth was another young person, a graduate student.
My name is Eliana Zacharias. I am a graduate student in the San Francisco State Museum Studies Program. And I am interning at the Asian Art Museum.
What is your 501c3 BS?
As a young professional, sometimes it's hard to like garner the respect of your peers, because they think, well, you're young, you don't really know how things run, and you could be in a director position as well as, you know, as another person who has been in the organization for years, and they may be older, but they don't see you as an equal because of your age, even though you have that same kind of rank as them. So that was something I had noticed, even just through, like, you know, not even me personally, but through my friends who are also my age.
Well, don't you feel, and I feel this, and I'm on the other side of the coin, mm-hmm. as you, but I feel sometimes my colleagues who are my age mm-hmm. will tend to really want millennial staff to do, like, social media marketing and tech things and all the things that they don't understand, but then they don't want to treat them as equals even though they're learning from them. And the other thing is they won't actually learn from them. Like, they'll say, you do it, instead of teach me how to do it.
Yeah, that typically happens. That's a very common experience for, you know, younger professionals that are expected to take over, like, social media accounts that haven't been, you know, tended to in years. And then they're like, well...
And they just assume you know everything because yeah. you're that age.
Right? Yeah, definitely. I mean, they're not wrong. We do have experience with it most of the time because social media is just kind of integrated into our lives now. Yeah. But even then, it's kind of just ostentatious to believe that, yeah, we'll rejuvenate your social media presence. We can start ad campaigns on your Instagram, your Twitter. That's totally fine. No, like, that's like an actual job. People do, like, actual work for it. They get degrees. They do studies. They know what works. And that's, like, a lot of marketing behind it. But, I mean, that assumption alone, just because of the age range, happens, you know, so often.
And do they expect you to take the traditional marketing and just adapt it rather than coming up with a new strategy specifically for social media?
It depends. If they have had anything already written for, like, that can be used for social media, then yeah, by all means, they'll probably just want you to, like, regurgitate that in a digital platform. But a lot of the times they don't have anything, and they're like, well, what do you young people use online? Like, what is the trend? What's the meme culture like right now? Can you use one of those things that, what are they called, GIFs or something? It's kind of ridiculous.
And you can't, I mean, what are you going to say, right? They're your bosses. You can't really sit down and educate them. And they don't want to be educated most of the time, right?
No, they don't. Do it. Yeah, a lot of the times it's like, well, I don't understand that. And I think that's kind of what happens when you get really used to a position. You get comfortable in a place. You're like, well, I no longer have to learn anything because I am in a very comfortable position. And I mean, that's always the danger when you get into like the like into a very like, you know, comfortable place. Like, I've worked this job for so many years and I know it forwards and backwards. So it's definitely that kind of culture as well.
And those are usually not the most innovative places.
No, and obviously that's just, it depends from organization to organization. Like I said, like in my own experience, at least with my recent internships, I haven't had to really like do any of that work, but a lot of my peers have had that experience, and it just depends on like where you are, the size of the organization, also what they expect you to accomplish in like in a internship, you know? Like, it depends on how long you're there.
So tell me one of your best experiences working in the museum field and one of your worst experiences. And you don't have to mention any names.
Oh, good. I need to retain a little bit of anonymity for at least these organizations' sake. I think I've had really great experiences. I think one of my first full-fledged internships I got with a children's museum in San Francisco, and it was like a boot camp, really. You're dedicated for 2 days a week, like 8 hours a day, so 16 hours a week for almost 3 months. But as much as it was that you had to dedicate that time, I actually really felt like they poured in so much like professional growth and development. And that's like the best kind of internship.
And what was one of the worst experiences you've had so far that made you think, oh my God, am I in the right field?
I don't know if it was like the worst experience I've had, but it was really like a reality experience because I did learn a lot from it, but I just was questioning as to what I was doing or if I was going in the right direction. I did work with a smaller institution one time, and their collections facility was, like, say the least, was not as, you know, put together. And this is a really common issue in museums. Like, now that I've know what's behind the scenes, like, there's a lot of the times where best practices can't be fulfilled because of budgetary restrictions and staff shortages. And maybe the director doesn't really put an importance on, like, you needing all of the proper materials to care for a collection. But I saw all of the, like, realities, like, uncared for collections and, you know, coworkers not really seeing eye to eye. So like there was already internal like problems, you know, at least within the staff. And I was just like, I don't know if it's just this museum or all museums or just collections. I mean, I obviously I'm in education now, so it just kind of, it kind of deterred me a little bit from collections. That was just a really big reality moment. And I think that was at the very start of my like interning with museums. But then I also did get that museum education interaction. And I was like, well, this is definitely what I want to do.
And that's why I do this show, because the mythology and the BS around our organizations can really affect people in our orbit. It can change careers. It can change the way people think, not just about us, but about what they want to do with the rest of their lives. And I can't wait to get much of this organizational BS out of the way so that we can all function better. Now we go from talking to someone who's just starting their career to someone who's had a long and illustrious one. My next guest teaches museum studies at the university level. She has a lot to say about the myths and mythology surrounding museums.
My name is Marjorie. I am a professor of museum studies at University of San Francisco in San Francisco, and I came here today to support my colleagues, my students, alumni who I've worked with, and to learn a few new things about museums.
Do you want to give your full name?
My name is Marjorie Schwartzer.
What is your 501c3 BS?
I used to believe that everything you read in a museum label was true. I would go to a museum, I would see an object, I would read the label, and of course everything that the label said was true, and that the object that the label was pointing to was indeed the object it said it was. It was made in the year it said it was made. It was donated by the person they said to donated it. It was made of the material, and it was from the country that they said it was from, etc. And in my many, many years now, I know that some labels are true, of course, and some are, let's say, open to interpretation. It may be because the label is still in its place, but the object has been switched out. So it's a different object. It may be because the curator came in with one perspective, a cultural perspective of what an object is, and never checked with people who are actually from that culture. So an example might be something that a Native American would have maybe used as a hair clip. This is an example somebody actually told me, and the label says it is a piece of jewelry that is worn as a necklace. And somebody who would actually know that culture would go, no, that's a hair clip. Or it may be that new information becomes available, but the label hasn't been updated. Or it may be that nobody really knows what country, or the border moved in the country. I think that people take label writing very seriously. Sometimes you have to switch a label at the last minute because the design of the exhibition changes. No, I don't think it is laziness or malfeasance. I think that it is just that there are so many moving parts in museums that every moving part things don't move at the exact same pace. I have problems with fixed labels altogether, but clearly there are digital options where you could fix the label digitally and just put in the correct information. You could swipe it. You could swipe it with your phone, and you could get it in different languages. You could get different perspectives. You could say you see an object and you get, this is what the art historian thinks. This is what the anthropologist thinks. This is what the collector thinks. This is what the educator thinks. This is how the 5-year-old child thinks of the object. This is what the scientists think. This is what the historian thinks, and you can use, you can actually get a great deal of information if you're curious, or you can just get cursory information if you're not curious. So there's many different ways that people want to learn about objects, and the label is static and is not as good as providing that information as other interpretive devices are.
Do you have some more BS for us?
Gosh. Oh, that every object is authentic. Okay, so what do we mean by that? Is the object really what, like we said, is the object really what it says it is? But did, here's an example of a typewriter maybe that was owned by a famous general. This actually came up at a session or in a conversation I had with someone today. Really? Are we sure that general owned that typewriter? Are we absolutely sure? Do we really have that paper trail? Well, not really. The provenance could be lacking. So some of the objects that we hold to be really dear, maybe it's a different object. Maybe the object is a stand-in. Maybe the object is a prop. Another myth is that many people feel they're not welcome in a museum. And museums are trying, and that used to be the case. There definitely is a historic reason for this. And
it wasn't that long ago either.
No, it wasn't that long ago. It really dates, well, there are some museums still. I'm even thinking about visitors, people who go, oh, I can't go there. I'm not dressed right. I don't have enough money to go there. This is not a place for me. I'm not welcome here. And that's really, it's a feeling that still exists, but legally and also in terms of the goodwill that educators are doing in museums and public relations people, and really the whole field, we really want people to come to museums. So museums are open to everybody. Everybody is welcome in museums. Another myth is that museums are overpriced. And the reality is that even the museums where you pay a heavy ticket price, like, say, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, which I think is $25 a pop, or let's say MoMA, I believe, is even more in New York, they are losing money for every visitor that walks in the door. So it costs them a lot more. You know this, you teach nonprofit management. It costs them a lot more to serve the public and do what they do than what you are paying when you walk in the door. Staffing is the number one cost, and then around taking care of the collection, and exhibitions are expensive to yeah. mount. Of course, another myth is that museums put everything they own on display. So you go into a museum and you think that you're seeing what the museum has. And most museums, now I'm not talking about the website, I'm talking about what you're seeing on the floor of the museum, as you know, only put about 5 to maybe 10% of what they own on display. So they're rotating work, they're storing work, they're loaning work. So you're only seeing 90 to 95%. I mean, you're only seeing, you're not seeing 90 to 95% of the collection.
Right.
So I'll give you one more, and then I see all my buddies coming out from the talk. So another myth is that museum people make a ton of money.
Is that a myth?
And I think we can, is that a good point
That's
to end
good.
On?
Thank you so much.
Our last interview for the day was the leader of a small state university's art gallery. What is your 501c3BS?
My name is Shelby Graham, and I'm the gallery director at the Mary Porter Cessnon Art Gallery at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And we're a small contemporary art gallery within a large institution. So a lot of people think that since we are an art gallery at a large university, that we have a lot of funding, and it's not true. And we also have a really large web presence and a small footprint, a small physical footprint. So when the myth I'd like to bust here is that people think since we're running so well, we must be well funded. But the reality is we do a great job with a small budget, and we're creative thinkers, problem solvers. And I'm trying to figure out how to teach people who want to quantify what we do in numbers, how to prove that how valuable we are with our innovative and creative thinking. So that's one of those myths that, you know, everything's fine.
Well, I hope we have all learned today a little bit about the museum sector and their mythologies. I want to thank the California Association of Museums and their annual conference for allowing me to be here today in Palm Springs. Thank you. Thank you for listening to 501c3BS, Deprogramming for Organizational Growth. I'm your host, Zu Velasco. 501c3BS is sponsored by the Gianeschi Center for Nonprofit Research at California State University Fullerton and the Mihalo School of Business. Join us at the Summer School for Nonprofits for one amazing week every August. Gianeschi is spelled G-I-A-N-N-E-S-C-H-I. That's G-I-A-N-N-E-S-C-H-I, Gianeschi Center for Nonprofit Research at California State University Fullerton and the Mihalo School of Business. Check out my Twitter feed at 501c3BS, my webpage at zootvelasco.com, and my book, The First 100 Days, on Amazon. The music is provided to us from our good friends at the traditional Brazilian choral group, Grupo Falso Baiano, and Amy Molinelli. Find them at grupofalsobaiano.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great day free from BS.